Only the best for agronomy. You go to the talks on molecular biology and it's wide open. Well, this is really a talk with a question mark, because I don't have an answer for you, but let's explore it. Let's explore the subject. Okay? And I'd like to suggest to you that we can anticipate four broad categories of transgenic cultivars and crops that are either here or on the horizon. Of course, one category that we all know well are pest and herbicide resistant varieties, or hybrids. And I would extend that to just pest and disease resistant non-transgenic varieties as well. There are issues about how you deploy them and how you manage them for optimal success. The second class would be altered composition for specific end uses. Third category would be those that might do better than existing germplasm in terms of resource acquisition and capture. Here we're thinking of nutrients and water, but it may extend to light someday. And four, increased tolerance of abiotic stresses. These include heat, drought, nutrient. Here I'm thinking deficiencies, nutrient toxicities, acidity, alkalinity, salinity, etc. If you take those broad categories as the most likely transgenics that we'll see in the foreseeable future, and thus need to consider dealing with in terms of management, let's look at them one by one. Well, I think for, again, this broad category of pest and herbicide resistance traits, again, transgenic, non-transgenic, they require strategies that avoid resistance buildup. And similar, of course, to the options that we have for Bacillus thuringiensis insect resistance and glyphosate herbicide tolerant crops. And I mentioned conventional disease. The story here I'm thinking of is when IR36 was about the second or third iteration of the miracle rices at Erie. IR36 was the most widely grown rice cultivar ever in the world. And at one time, it was so successful, it further shortened growth duration compared to IR8, which was the first, by about 12 days, gave almost the same yield, allowed farmers to grow two and sometimes three crops per year on the same piece of land in Asia. At one time, it was grown on 12 million hectares, often double cropped. You're talking about 24 to 30 million hectares of IR36 in Asia. And within no time, there was leafhopper resistance was lost. Diseases like blast and leaf spot took over, and it just wiped out this very, very valuable cultivar in about 3 years. So this is not new. This is simply how to deploy useful germplasm with disease and herbicide resistance so that we protect the value of those resistances. So I think the issue for us as agronomists, are we doing a good enough job? Because these transgenic traits, I mean, anyone that's seen glyphosate use in a no-till system, it's phenomenal. It's allowed us to then extend the usefulness of other important agronomic traits that really protect environmental quality, reduce erosion, reduce energy inputs, and so forth. Well, I think and this is where the question mark starts coming in, because I'm not the expert. What I hear, and possibly we discuss it later, is that so far, with the single BT traits, we're doing a pretty good job. That the 20% refugia requirements seem to be protecting the value of those resistant traits. I think it's a different story for herbicide resistance. And this is a plot. Any of you can go to this website. It's real time. They're always bringing in new reports of weed species that have been found to be resistant by weed scientists. And the number just keeps growing. And it seems to be that when you exert this incredibly strong selection pressure on any community of plants, which is what glyphosate does. It's such a good non-specific herbicide. You select for tolerance or resistance. So it seems, I think the bottom line here, I think even the companies that have a vested interest in this trait now realize in retrospect that they probably did not invest enough in protecting the value of that trait. So I'm not going to go on to this last question here about stack BT traits, because this is a game changer. The rules here change the refugia to allow, I think, 5%, is that right?
10%.
So it's gone from 20 to 10.
Now 5.
And then 5%. Okay, so 5% is on the way. This is an incredibly exciting area for population ecology in terms of answering the question how that works. But I suggest to you that that it seems to me that companies that have a vested interest in these kinds of traits should be the ones that are the most cautious. Because if they're wrong, they actually lose credibility in being able to tell regulators that they really understand the system and this is, we can do it. But they end up losing the value of those traits in their portfolio of seed for sale to customers. I don't know the answer. Tony Vinn is going to talk about it in more detail. And he'll provide us the answer. I'd like to move now to compositional traits. There are some easy ones, of course. Higher oil, higher protein, higher starch. Starch for ethanol, protein for feed, oil for feed or fine or other end uses. And obviously, these traits require management practices that optimize expression of that trait and post-harvest handling for identity preservation. But this is not new. We've been doing this a long time. We've been doing it with bread wheat. We do it with malting barley. We do it with organic fruits and vegetables. So to think that we need a new agronomy for expressing these traits and protecting them in an identity-preserved value chain, I'm not sure I see the argument. Now, that would be for kind of mass-produced, just higher protein in general, not a specific type of protein or starch. I think it gets maybe a little more, the issue is a little more complicated if we're talking about very high-value oils or proteins or starches with a very specific end use. Here we might think about nutraceuticals or pharmaceuticals. And I'm not sure. Much more difficult because clearly there's going to be isolation requirements. You're going to have to keep these things very well segregated from the commodity at large. And there may be management practices that optimize these things that we haven't thought of. However, the scale of production that we're talking about here for these high-value oils, proteins, starches, probably not large, or nutraceuticals. You know, you're talking about thousands of acres or hectares. That the amount of total demand for these fine products, it's not going to be a large-scale, not likely to be a large-scale agronomic issue. So we're moving now to the third class, greater acquisition, resource acquisition traits. We can think of root influence traits in terms of water acquisition from a deeper soil profile. We can think of that directly in terms of transforming, changing a trait that allows either more resource allocation to roots for them to grow deeper or changing size of roots and such so that, again, there's more, less investment per root centimeter of root length and allowing greater root length and deeper roots. And you can think of this in an indirect effect as alleviating an abiotic stress such as acidity, tolerance to soil acidity in subsoil that allows roots to grow deeper into an acid subsoil. This would be particularly a case in tropical soils. We can think of traits that might increase uptake of nutrients. So nitrogen, phosphorus. In the case of phosphorus, we have some examples already. Just conventional germplasm, proteoid roots, we've seen that some plants excrete organic acids that then allow them to acquire more phosphorus. And some work, I think, being done on micronutrients. We've heard about light. We've probably exploited canopy architecture, at least in our major cereals, in terms of leaf erectness. Some talk about changing canopy habit from prostrate leaves during the early growth phase, and then they would change to more erect leaves at some point in growth. So an inducible change during growth that would capture more light during the growing season. Certainly a possibility. I haven't seen any indication that there are such genotypes out there. But we're back to the fundamental question then. We have some of these transgenics. Do they require a new agronomy? So, for root influence traits, they're likely to involve, if we get such plants, likely to involve a carbon cost. So deeper roots, more carbon investment in roots, unless you were to change the investment per unit root length by changing the root diameter. But there are problems with thinking about how fine roots would penetrate deep in a soil subsoil profile. Again, if you're looking at these phosphorus tolerance mechanisms, they require investment in carbon. So there's trade-offs. Point here is there's trade-offs. And improved N acquisition is not likely for major cereals. And I'd like to spend a bit of time on this point, meaning that we are not, as agronomists, not likely to be under pressure to have to come up with management practices for improved N acquisition genotypes. The reason is that the competence for major cereal crops, and I think Tom Sinclair made the point earlier, we're talking about crops that have been bred and selected for a long period of time, your major cereals. There are some crops that haven't had a lot of breeding work, and there may be possibility still in things like canola or other crops. But this, we're talking here about the major cereals. Turns out that for important yield-determining traits like nitrogen acquisition capacity, cereal crops have overcapacity. So these are data for rice. They show the uptake capacity shown in kilograms per hectare per day. When you measure over short periods, a lot of the previous literature would have measured, the question is, what's the rate of nitrogen uptake, the maximum nitrogen uptake for rice? And they would measure it over a 7-day period. That's too long. The uptake capacity is so rapid that it's occurring in the first few days. So these are, this is in a well-managed field of rice. You're applying 50 or 100 kilograms of nitrogen at this point in time here. If you apply 100 kilograms of nitrogen, this is the uptake rate. It's 12 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per day. And so it's taken up within 8 days, it's taken up, you've taken up 80 kilograms and the other 20 kilograms have been lost to denitrification or other lost pathways. And for 50 kilograms, it's a slightly lower rate, but 10 kilograms per hectare per day. This is over capacity in terms of uptake rate. We can think of maybe it can use that nitrogen more efficiently. This is work by Stuart Wiest many years ago at UC Davis. The plant actually, we can think of, I've heard it proposed that plants take nitrogen up for a longer period during grain filling. Turns out there's no evidence that if nitrogen is available, the plant loses any competence to take up nitrogen during grain filling. It's a matter of supply. And once that nitrogen's taking up, it allocates, particularly after grain filling, it allocates 90% of what's taken up to grain. Very efficient. We also know that the uptake parameters at the root surface that govern uptake at the root surface, we understand these processes very well. And as Tom Sinclair showed us, you can model it. And when it's been modeled, you can look at the parameters that you can change parameters and look at the, in these spider diagrams, look at the sensitivity of it. And these are the parameters that govern uptake at the root surface. And the point is that there's only three that have any potential, any plasticity for increasing rate of uptake. One of them's root diameter, not a very promising. If you create fat roots, you lose competence for taking up immobile nutrients like phosphorus or potassium. Rate of growth of roots, which is K, a maximum uptake at the root surface. Turns out that in this case, it's a very, very high concentration of nitrogen, so that the maximum uptake would not be so sensitive in a soil environment. But there's good news about nitrogen uptake. That is that, and that's my assessment, that nitrogen uptake by major crops is not limited by uptake parameters at the root surface or by root lake density. Root diameter may be a plastic or sensitive parameter, but fat roots are not a favorable trait. And I think the one that's not received attention here is modification of root distribution in the soil profile. I'd like to spend a minute or two on this. If you look at crops that are tap-rooted, and if you look at the fact that most of our management in intensive agricultural systems concentrates nutrients in surface soil, there's a mismatch. I'm going to show you an example for cotton in the San Joaquin Valley, where most of the cotton is produced on these K-fixing soils on the eastern slope that are derived from alluvium from the Sierra Nevada eastern slope. They're vermiculitic. They fix potassium, very low in potassium. And you end up getting terrible potassium deficiency unless you correct it. Correct it here. Deficient out here. Looks like a flamethrower is taken to the crop. And the problem is that over the years, you've got a deeply tap-rooted crop exploring a deep soil profile, and any crop residue that's returned, which recycles the potassium or any fertilizer that's applied, the other crop rotated here is alfalfa, also deep and tap-rooted, sticks in the surface soil because of the K fixation capacity. Nothing moves down that profile. So we're concentrating nutrients, and of course, if there are pathogens as well. And yet our root distribution is deeply tap-rooted. And the question is, how plastic are roots to the vertical? Oh, by the way, this is occurring in your no-till systems all through the Midwest. We're heavily concentrating nutrients now in a narrow surface soil layer. So the question is, how plastic are roots to vertical distribution of nutrients? Well, there's a tremendous amount of genetic diversity among species. So these are data taken from a paper published in 1989 by Steve Gulick. And each one of these columns is a treatment. It's a PVC pipe about a meter deep. And in these pipes, 20 centimeters, you can grow a large cotton plant or barley plant. And in these, you have treatments that are complete subsoil, very low in nutrient supply, particularly potassium, and then increasing depths of topsoil in which much higher levels of available potassium and other nutrients are. The fibrous barley root system tracks those nutrients like a heat-seeking missile. So this is the root length density following the depth of topsoil up to 100 kilometers per meter cubed, the black, and the cotton root system doesn't see it. So it seems that there would be tremendous potential to change root system architecture to match the trend in distribution of nutrients that's occurring from management. Of course, the reason for this in cotton is simple, that if you're ever lucky enough to have to go on a germplasm collection trip for cotton, it's indigenous to the native littoral strand in Central America. And so one has to go to Costa Rica and Honduras. It's very difficult. So I guess, is there potential to modify taproot habit to a more fibrous root system for systems that are well-watered, high-yield, and where nutrient stratification exists or is occurring? This would be the Midwest Corn Belt under no-till, as well as irrigated systems, and particularly in soils that have fixation properties, whether it's P or K. Let's look at the last class here of increased tolerance of abiotic stress. We can think of heat, drought, nutrients. This is more of a fit. This is not acquisition so much when we're talking about nutrients, but ability to produce yield with low concentrations, internal tissue concentrations of a nutrient, or withstand toxicities or acidity. And the question here is, are there trade-off free traits? If yes, no problem, let's deploy them. If no, that is, if there are no trade-off free traits, we've got to use detailed information on geospatial distribution of soils, using crop simulation models, long-term weather data, to ensure that we're deploying them in areas where it's worth the trade-off. And so we're talking about here then site-specific management in large-scale agriculture, and if we're going to use these in small-scale agriculture in developing countries, it's going to be more of a field-specific management. So, I'll talk a little bit about nitrogen efficiency. Tom's talked about drought tolerance. It's all focused on nitrogen. Salinity I won't talk about, but I think here the concern is, yes, it looks like there's genetic variation in salinity tolerance that we can exploit, transgenic traits that might improve salinity tolerance. Problem here is that you would deploy them in environments that one might question whether it's sustainable long-term to crop in those environments. Because essentially what you're doing is salinizing the profile. You're going to grow crops in an area, particularly if it's irrigated, such that the salinity level will essentially rise to the level of tolerance, of the new level of higher salinity tolerance that you've created. I think episodic heat or water stress is interesting. These would be inducible traits. These would not be traits that would be constitutively expressed throughout growth, but induced only during, for instance, an episodic period of high temperature or a short-term episodic period of water stress. The nitrogen, I think, which is a lot of interest, of course, the idea being you can reduce the amount of nitrogen fertilizer applied, much more environmentally friendly, reduces greenhouse gas emissions. I think we have to question it right up front, whether that there's physiological tolerance of low nitrogen. And the best data, I think, that describes this are the Greenwood curves that show, very interesting here, the nitrogen concentration in above-ground tissues at different levels of crop biomass when these crops are grown at optimal growth rate. And these yield levels are obtained by sampling the crop at different growth stages. So during early growth, crops have low biomass and their tissues have high nitrogen concentration. And at later growth stages, they have high biomass and lower nitrogen concentration. But all along the growth period, they have been growing at optimal growth rates, that growth rates that achieve the maximum use of solar radiation. In this case, they're not limited by water. The point is that when Greenwood and colleagues looked at this, tried to generate these curves for all C4 plants and all C3 crops, major crops, they fell all on the same curve when you took out the biomass versus end concentration curve. it's the excitement here is how robust these relationships are as benchmarks. So we can take these data for maize in Nebraska, where we expressly try to grow the crop without limit, and they fall on the predicted curve, the Greenwood curves. Now in water limitation, I think, again, tolerance of drought, the trade-off issue becomes so critical. That is, if you can't induce it just at the stage of stress. And the best example here is the danger we have in spending a lot on developing a trade-off-driven drought tolerance is that essentially what we're doing is investing in creating the sorghum plant from the maize plant. And this shows that here in terms of in Kansas and Nebraska, there are many counties that grow both sorghum and maize under rain-fed conditions. Sorghum is much more drought tolerant than maize. And thus, when you do it, this is 10 years of data, in every county in Kansas and Nebraska that grows significant acreage of both sorghum and maize under rain-fed conditions. And indeed, sorghum out-yields maize in very droughty years. And this increase is like 20 or 25% higher yields than maize under drought, in drought years. In good years, sorghum underperforms maize by a smaller percentage, actually, 10 to 15%. But a small percentage on a large yield is a large number, and a large percentage on a small yield is a small number, and farmers are not going to adopt this variety or cultivar at the expense of the good years. Farmers farm, farmers make their money and survive on the good years, not the bad years. So here we are. We end up with yield as a function of G by E by M. And the question is, once a grower has selected the best adapted, highest yielding cultivar or hybrid for his field, is there a need for customized management for that genotype? And here we're broadening it. Let's make this any genotype, not just transgenic. Is there a need for customizing for each hybrid or cultivar? Is that an avenue that as agronomists we should be investing in? My answer is, I guess, and I don't think so. But if it's yes, we have a problem. Houston, we have a problem, because there's an increasingly short period that these hybrids and cultivars remain commercial, because the turnover is so rapid. So by the time you calibrate your agronomics for this new hybrid, it's now changed for another one. So do we need new agronomy for transgenic crops? Again, in general, no. And I would caution a major effort down this path. Instead, the key challenge is to select the most appropriate cultivar hybrid for a given field and use your best management practices for that area. So the question becomes, how do you select the best cultivar hybrid? Well, obviously you have varietal trial data, you have your seeds person, and you have simulation models and historical weather data to help you with maturity, planting date, and plant population. Now, I think the challenge comes in these new stacked BT varieties and in herbicide tolerance. That remains a huge challenge. And we must work closely with our entomology and pathology colleagues and the ecologists on this. Options already used for these end traits, I'm not worried about that. And cost-effective deployment of abiotic stress traits must be guided by delineation of where it would benefit from their use in terms of geospatial delineation, either within a field, if there's that much variability, or on a regional basis. And open for questions, if there's time.
Thank you, Dr. Cass. I think we'll have to hold questions.